Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
It was a landslide election victory that put an end to 14 years of Conservative Party rule. But just how did British Prime Minister Keir Starmer achieve this sweeping success? Get In tells the inside story of how a fragmented Labour Party managed to rebuild from the brutal defeat of 2019 to parliamentary victory in 2024 and captures the role of the influential Irishman Morgan McSweeney, seen as the architect of Keir Starmer's path to power. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by the authors of Get In, the inside story of Labour under Starmer, Patrick Maguire, political columnist for The Times, and Gabriel Pogrand, Whitehall editor for The Sunday Times. Gentlemen, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
You're going to have to forgive me straight away for our almost completely parochial interest in your book and Morgan McSweeney and pushing Keir Starmer slightly to the side. Tell us, please, where, Gabriel, that relationship started and who spotted who first?
Well, I'm not sure we can accept parochial. We have subjected ourselves to many hours retracing McSweeney's stories from Macroom in West Cork to Westminster, and he is sort of the joint protagonist of this tale. He has this sort of radical and quite deep loathing for the hard left, as he perceives it, of British progressive politics, having worked. He never worked in politics in Ireland. He came to London as a teenager and ended up quite accidentally working for the Labour Party, and later in local government in South London, where he was confronted by the legacy of the left-wing leadership of the council, which was a child abuse scandal, which the leadership had entirely missed. And in his mind, he could sort of draw a direct line between the indulgence of left-wing politics and that sort of outcome. And he committed himself and his life to defeating the left, bringing the party back to the centre. And when Jeremy Corbyn was at his height, McSweeney spent a lot of time considering how in due course he could put a candidate in front of the party's membership that would later on be able to quite subtly shift the party's position. So he didn't know Starmer very well. They were introduced by a mutual friend who's now the Environment Secretary. But we've described that the dynamic was that McSweeney was the man with the machine, but he didn't have a candidate. Starmer, not a very political person, was the candidate without the machine, and the rest is history.
Wow. So, Patrick, to what extent then in Keir Starmer did Morgan McSweeney find an empty vessel with political ambition that he was able to fill with these ideas of how Labour should present itself?
This is the question at the heart of the book and the question that's been animating Westminster since the Labour Party got its hands on it this week. The question is whether is Keir Starmer an empty vessel, or is he self-aware enough to recognise in Morgan McSweeney a burning sort of political desire to do the things Keir Starmer doesn't want to do? Keir Starmer, strangely for the Prime Minister of a G7 country, does not like politics, the stuff of politics. He's not particularly interested in the Labour Party or questions of political or electoral strategy. He's much more of an administrator, a sort of non-executive chairman figure. And I think it's certainly true that Morgan McSweeney in 2019, when he was looking for a candidate who could win back the Labour membership from the hard left, he saw in Keir Starmer a sort of, not quite a blank canvas, but someone who had fairly amorphous progressive values rather than a defined politics. And, you know, that has sort of continued. And Keir Starmer has always been willing, like any good barrister, to viciously prosecute the brief Morgan McSweeney has given him. And that was in 2020, a sort of let's all be friends, happy clappy Corbynism in a suit. And now it's a much harder edged sort of right wing version of Labour politics. So, you know, I think it's a mutually beneficial relationship that recognises their respective strengths.
Gabriel, what is Morgan McSweeney? Is he a Blairite or is he just a ruthless pragmatist?
Wonderful question, and one that we've spent some time contemplating. I mean, in some ways, he has a kind of equal scepticism for hard left politics and Blairite politics. One of his sort of big formative moments after South London, to which I referred, was he went across the capital to Dagenham, which in the mid-noughties was in the grip of this far-right insurgency. The British Nationalist Party was propagating the idea that the UK government was paying Africans to migrate there and steal council housing from white working class residents. It looked for a time like the BNP, having won a council seat there, might win parliamentary seats as well. And McSweeney sort of recognised that, that there was a problem, and it wasn't just the far left, but also, you know, Tony Blair had sort of lost touch with the working class roots of the party and his sort of globalisation, pro-migration agenda had left people feeling like disenfranchised and alienated. And I'm sure that your listeners don't have time to get into the weeds of this, but McSweeney is very associated with something called Blue Labour, which is this idea of, you know, Labour reconnecting with its roots culturally as well. You know, this was a party which was ashamed of things like the British flag, like singing the national anthem. And he wanted to reconnect the party as being a patriotic populist party as well.
So, Patrick, would it be fair to say that what Morgan McSweeney's superpower is to be able to grapple with those issues that most Labour backroom people felt slightly squeamish about, particularly migration?
Exactly. It is that feeling that the Labour Party often loses because it looks inwards and primarily concerns itself with how the liberal left would feel rather than its target voters. And this is an age-old story across the Western world. You know, the traditional working class, as the economy has changed, turn away from the left and the left turns into itself. And, you know, he has always been very critical of how the left relates to its target voters and how past Labour leaders, everybody from Corbyn to Blair to Ed Miliband, have related to them. And that has meant grasping the nettle on migration. It has meant criticising, you know, some of the people Keir Starmer would be natural bedfellows with, i.e. judges, lawyers, civil servants, that sort of thing. You know, he told friends, why should Labour be the party for the BBC, for the judges, for Gary Lineker earning £2 million a year? And it's an interesting thing for, you know, Irish people to consider, because it's taken a, you know, an Irishman from Macroom to get Labour to sing God Save the Queen. I mean, we do relate in the book that when they did that in Conference 2022, a Labour's party conference, Morgan McSweeney didn't go quite as far as singing God Save the King himself. But, you know, he's the man who's put the Union Jack on Labour's leaflets. You know, people who have heard these from a Fine Gael family might not necessarily be surprised by that if you're a Fine Foiler. You know, it's interesting. It's taken Irishman to do that to the Labour Party. It's a fascinating story.
All of this, if you weren't watching UK politics, I think people might be inferring a level of absolute political brilliance here about Morgan McSweeney. Fact of the matter is, though, Gabriel, it's not going too well at the moment, is it?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because he might seem like the hero of the story. To others, he's the anti-hero. And there's no doubt that a question mark which continues to hover over the government, and indeed McSweeney, is, you know, notwithstanding his ruthlessness, notwithstanding the astonishing scale of Starmer's landslide last July, what in actual fact is this all for? I mean, what is the ultimate objective? Patrick and I didn't endear ourselves to the Downing Street operation when, hot on the heels of their victory, we published a story disclosing that Starmer had been looking to a party donor to fund his spectacles, clothes and his wife's dresses. And this was a story which ended up taking lots of attention and heat and time for the government in its first 100 days. But that would never have happened had there been greater clarity about quite what it was that it wanted to do. Over the last fortnight or so, the government has started to pivot towards growth. That seems to be the big strap line. Everybody's tattooed that word to their head. But, you know, there are lots of sort of intellectual and policy contradictions, you know, within the government and indeed within Starmer himself, which is why, quite extraordinarily, Starmer's polling has actually fallen beneath Rishi Sunak's basement. To the more hawk-eyed followers of British politics, you may recall that our former Prime Minister announced the last general election without the assistance of an umbrella, being completely soaked by rain outside Number 10. It was a sort of physical, it was a sort of amazing metaphor for what had happened to the Tories by then. Starmer's beneath that now, and that is because while you have, you know, Nigel Farage's reform
on one side with her very unambiguous message about what's gone wrong with the country, and you know, the left know exactly what they don't like about Starmer, that there has always been this question, which is, what exactly is Starmer? And in the book, I'll just say, we quote Keir Starmer himself when confronted by a left winger who was angrily accusing him of dragging the party to the right. He said, there is no such thing as Starmerism and there never will be, which at least keeps journalists like us in business.
Same question to both of you. Are Morgan McSweeney and Keir Starmer inextricably joined at the hip now? Or might Morgan McSweeney, who has a reputation for absolute ruthlessness, if you do anything that's going to drag down the name of the party, that's it, you're gone, one offence and you are out. Might he look at his own Prime Minister and say, maybe you weren't the empty vessel that I was looking for?
That is the question that hangs over the entire book. And it's certainly true that there are lots of people in Downing Street and in Keir Starmer's cabinet who, if pushed, would probably pick Morgan McSweeney over Keir Starmer. Now, the grit in the oyster is Morgan McSweeney has only had the space to do what he's done to the Labour Party, turn it on its head, in his own words, because Keir Starmer gave him that space. Even if he is an empty vessel, he appoints Morgan McSweeney. Morgan McSweeney serves at his pleasure. There are lots of points in our story where Morgan McSweeney asks friends, you know, I don't know what Keir Starmer thinks. Will I stay in this job, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there is an awareness from both men. You know, Keir Starmer's biographer, Tom Baldwin, who also wrote a very good book about this, describes their relationship as transactional. And I think there's definitely a mutual feeling, you know, of respect, admiration, not quite affectional friendship. But I don't think Morgan McSweeney right now would say or argue that there is any other show in town other than Keir Starmer. But who knows? One day, if Keir Starmer falls out of love with politics, I think he's actually much likelier to give up than Morgan McSweeney, you know, giving him the revolver and the whiskey.
Do you agree, Gabriel?
I'd echo everything Patrick said. One quote of the book which has generated a lot of controversy in Westminster was words uttered by McSweeney at one of the low points of Starmer's leadership in 2021, when he said the following: Keir Starmer, he's not political. He's very bright. He picks things up fast, but he has some sense of skullduggery, but not like the people surrounding him. And he went on, Keir acts like an HR manager, not a leader. What's the point of circling the wagons if you can't last? So you've got the Prime Minister's own chief of staff comparing him to a human resources professional rather than a leader or a politician, which I think affirms everything Patrick was saying, which is that this is a transaction. It's not a love affair. It's not two men who've got a shared project or tradition. It's the machine and the candidate and the machine. And at the point that it's not mutually agreeable or beneficial, then I suspect, with acrimony or not, it will probably cease to exist.
You're making him sound, Patrick, like he is completely one of the most formidable human beings that you have ever met. But I've only seen him speaking publicly once, and he's actually quite soft-spoken in manner, and some of the profiles of him that I have read suggest that he's actually very amenable, almost gregarious kind of chap.
Yeah, look, I don't think people would meet Morgan McSweeney and necessarily think he is perhaps, as you say, formidable and terrifying, as sections of our book might make him seem. You know, he is in many respects an ordinary guy from Cork, even if his accent has faded a little bit.
There's no such thing.
Well, exactly. Well, it depends where you're listening from, I guess. But that is one of the compelling things about this story, and one of the big, you know, why it's a story without parallel in British political history. You know, a guy from Macroom turns up in London at 17, and within 30 years he is running the country. You know, and I think, you know, if we tell the story in the book of when he met another important Irishman in this story, former Labour MP called Conor McGinn from South Armagh, who was is the son of a former Sinn Féin councillor. And, you know, with the first time they ever met, they're talking about, you know, do you prefer the big ball or the small ball, i.e. football or hurling? So it was, you know, that Irishness is still there at the fore of Morgan McSweeney. And, you know, he's back regularly. You know, what was the first thing he did after the election result? It wasn't necessarily spend the weekend in number 10 planning for government. It was going to watch Cork beat Limerick in the All-Ireland semi-final.
Okay.
Yeah, indeed. You know, he flew back almost immediately to get to Croke Park. So I think, you know, if people bumped into him in the streets of Cork or in the pub in Macroom, they would think, do you really run the UK? But apparently he does.
In fairness to Keir Starmer, because I think this needs to be said at this point in this interview, Gabriel, if you had been writing this book about Tony Blair this early on in his premiership, you probably would have concluded that he also was an empty vessel, yet he went on to become one of the most consequential figures of British political history in the 20th and 21st century. Might you be premature in arriving at the conclusions that you have about Keir Starmer?
It's a really interesting critique. Yeah, definitely one we welcome. Alistair Campbell, another gentleman obviously associated with Tony Blair, said that he'd spoken to a cabinet minister who said that our book was the sort of tome that you expect to read at the end of a premiership rather than at the beginning. And I suspect he said that for two reasons. The first is that the level of detail is reasonably copious, and that's probably because we've wasted our ill-spent youth talking to people in the Labour Party in pubs dotted around London, and once the momentum on a project like this gets underway, people do feel the need to dip their hands in the blood and speak to the journalists. But also, there is a fragmentation and a big question mark at the heart of the project, as we've been discussing, which is who and what is Starmer? And you mentioned the case of Blair. I mean, if you ask people what the atmosphere was like in his first term, the answer was often pretty rotten. We had Bernie Eccleston scandal, Mandelson resigning once and then twice. There were all sorts of questions about the political definition of the government. But one thing I will say that distinguishes Blair from Starmer is that Blair was always the architect of his own project. He shared a parliamentary office with Gordon Brown. He shared a parliamentary office with Gordon Brown, with whom he was joint at the hip until he wasn't. Him and Mandelson as well were very close friends, and they were dedicated to this idea of dragooning the party from the left to the centre, and believed that that was the kind of moral and political imperative, in a way which Starmer, as a man who loathes politics and is frankly disinterested in it on a social and an intellectual level, doesn't. Does that mean that he won't end up being consequential, that he can't copy Blair by, you know, in due course giving effect to significant things? No, and I will say too that if you look at the letter of their policy, what they're doing on planning, on infrastructure, I mean, there are heavy vested interests that are going to array themselves against some of the more controversial dimensions of his project. But if Starmer, the HR manager and the technocrat, just does things which, you know, Britain's sclerotic planning and legal system has prohibited for a generation, then yes, the history books might record that he was a consequential prime minister, possibly despite and rather than because of his political self.
Just so long as he doesn't go to war in Iraq. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Get In, the definitive behind-the-scenes account of Labour's brutal reinvention and dramatic return to power under Keir Starmer. Published by Penguin, available now. Thank you very much to Patrick McGuire and Gabriel Pogrund for joining us this morning.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.